So I'll begin this discussion about the third faculty, sati, with a little story that I heard right after 9/11. And maybe, I think probably many of you have heard it, and now it's been said many times, and I don't have it exactly verbatim how I heard it. It was a story that was attributed to a Native American story, of a Native American boy who was sitting with his grandfather, an elder, and the elder said to the boy, "There are two wolves inside of me that are fighting. One is good, one is bad, one wants to harm, one wants peace, one is angry, one is peaceful, loving." And so the boy asks, "Well, who's going to win the war?" And the elder says, "Whichever one I feed. Whichever one I feed." And this is could almost be, without, so it's kind of dramatic language, and some people don't like good and bad, and probably that's not, wasn't in the story. It probably had some other kind of dichotomies. But the Buddha also talked about what we feed. He used the, in English, when he spoke English. then it's, which he does in my books, is sometimes nourishment and sometimes nutriment. But I think the word just means food. So whatever food you feed yourself. And then we're talking about the psychological food, the spiritual food that we can do. And so when Andrea talked yesterday about, you know, maintaining, sustaining the wholesome, the skillful states, is to recognize them and appreciate them there is considered part of the food for what keeps them going. And the Buddha said that the food for tranquility is tranquility. So, which means that you should notice when you're tranquil, because that feeds it, keeps it going. And then you know, he talked about the food, what supports and feeds the hindrances, for example. Something you don't really want to feed. Though maybe some of you have been like me, happily feeding them during the retreat. You know, having ill will towards someone and really thinking out, what are we going to do to that person when I see that person? And that's good food for ill will, to just kind of in those fantasies. So what are you feeding here? So there's two different choices, kind of. And this idea that there's two choices is in really deeply integral to the Dharma practice. There's what's skillful and there's what's unskillful. There's what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. There's also, and those are kind of like nicely paired, like they're almost opposite. There's another kind of distinction the Buddha makes between the kind of thoughts we have that are more constructing the self, building up the self, making the self up. And those thoughts are part of, usually, part of the common theme of discursive thinking, telling stories to ourselves, planning, remembering what happened to ourselves. Usually, the kind of thinking where we're part of it, partly, so one way or the other, we're a central character in it, in the story, in the event, or have it closely identified with it. And so, you know, I used to, when I was young, in the Dharma, you know, sometimes had delusions of grandeur about, I would listen to my abbot give Dharma talks and thought, oh, well, someday I'll give Dharma talks. But back, now I do, but I don't think that highly of them. But back then I thought highly of them. I didn't even give them, it was all in my head. So that was kind of like all about me and building myself up and all that. And so this, so that is called constructing a self, building it up. And there's another way of thinking, another way of being, that are kind of thoughts that are really not about you in the standard usual kind of way. It's not egotistical, it's not self-centered, it's not trying to make something up. They might be related to your experience and your path and the Dharma, but it isn't like you're trying to create a self or build a self or make a better self, and it isn't oriented in that way. And that way of thinking is emergent. That way of thinking is generative. It's something that's generated from deeper inside us that that is not self-preoccupied. And it's the same, I'd like to suggest, same place it arises from within as when Andrea so beautifully emphasized that wisdom knows. Wisdom abandons. You don't do the work. Wisdom does. And that's a remarkable paradigm shift from thinking that you have to do everything. It's up to you to figure it out, up for you to do the work, versus that, no, it doesn't have to be you. You have your role in this, but there is within us something different that can, from which something can emerge that's not constructed by the self. It's not consciously, or it's not intentionally or deliberately, or part of that kind of building and making up ourselves, our future, our world, our fantasies, our imaginations, some of which are projections that we project onto the world and we project on ourselves. It's we internalize so much with the world around us, what they tell us, and then we believe that's the case. We see ourselves that way. But now there's something deep inside that almost we learn how to get out of the way of. We allow the discursive mind to be quiet enough so there's space in the mind for a different process to operate. And there are these two different processes. And the one that's not healthy, the wolf that's not healthy, is simplistically involves greed, hate, and delusion. That's the categories of things. The 17, the other, basically reading the book, it was 17 defilements, that 17 imperfections that defile the mind. I think the Pali can also be translated as the 17 afflictions that soil the mind, whatever they are still. Those are all part of this kind of constructive world. So that particular sutta goes on, and once someone has experienced freedom from these 17, even temporarily, in a clear enough definitive way that know that there's a possibility of an inner purity or inner ethical cleansing, an inner kind of openness, kind of very fresh and open, and this kind of spacious feeling of being clean on the inside. And it makes such a big impression, wow, this is possible. And then person has this kind of verified confidence. Then the text goes on and says that with that inspiration, there is born, there emerges delight. It doesn't say a person now kind of cranks up the delight engine and gets their delight really going. You rev yourself up. No, it's the inspiration that brings to light, wow, this is possible. Isn't that fantastic? there's a whole other way of living, a whole other way of being, a paradigm change from the way that I used to think. I had to always plan and figure out and defend and apologize and make things up and make sure that present myself so that people see me in a certain way, and I have to prove myself and get a job and a lot of money or a lot of praise, or a successful life is a life where I get a really good mate, and I have to kind of like, you know, figure out how to do that. And some of those things are, you know, anyway, so then there's this whole other way that we're not working so hard. We're not trying to make something happen, but we're creating the conditions to allow something to happen. And so this delight arises. And from that delight, there is born, Buddha uses the language born, joy. And from that joy, the body becomes tranquil. And with that tranquility, happiness arises. And with that happiness arising, concentration appears. None of those are described as something a person does. But if the mind is crowded with fantasies and worries and judgments about oneself and about others, and then there's no room for something to emerge, something, the wisdom to emerge, the joy and delight to emerge. We have a role to play, and that role is partly to make space, make room for something to occur. And there's a few analogies that Buddha uses for this process. My favorite one is a hen sitting on her eggs. And the hen does not make the eggs grow, the chicks grow in the egg. The hen just provides the conditions. She sits on them and makes them warm and cozy and just creates the right conditions so that the chicks inside can grow until they hatch. And it's a little bit humorous to me, at least. The Buddha says, even if the chick does not want, even if the hen does not want the chicks to hatch, if the conditions are right, they will hatch. So that's not so humorous until you realize that he says the same thing about becoming enlightened. If you sit on your eggs, if you sit on that which can incubate inside of you, the Dharma incubation, if those are there, then even if you don't want to be enlightened, you will be. Isn't that, you're laughing. maybe you're laughing because it seems so unbelievable. But that's what he says. Or he talks about a farmer has to do farmer work, has to plow the fields, plant the seeds, water. But the farmer, he says, cannot command the plants to grow, unless the farmer has psychic powers, he says in a footnote. But ordinary farmers, you can't make the plants grow. But in with the time and season, the plants will grow. In Japan, there's a poem that says something like, you can't take an axe into the cherry tree to look for the cherry blossoms. But when the spring breeze blows across the tree, the blossoms come out. It's So you can't force certain things. Some things you have to just allow to happen. So maybe you don't like the idea of eggs in you, but maybe there's cherry blossoms in you. But you can't take the axe. There's some people who liken concentration to a well-honed, sharp axe. Other people liken concentration to beautiful, still, quiet lake. All the water becomes still and soft, and there appears the lotus blossoms in that lake. So I kind of prefer the first over the axe metaphor. But this beautiful lake. So this is a long way introduction to, you know, lead up to a topic of sati. That in the sati, as I've kind of studied the suttas and come to understand it, the Buddha never tells us to do sati. We're never told to do mindfulness. What do? I do mindfulness practice. I'm doing mindfulness. Leave me alone, I'm doing my mindfulness. But actually the Buddha never said to do it. It was closer to maybe the English way, strictly in the kind of strict grammatic way, be mindful as opposed to do mindfulness. If my mom wanted me to be mindful when I was young, she used to be mindful, Gil. Walking across the clean kitchen floor with muddy shoes. But she was telling me to do the mindfulness thing that way. But the being of mindfulness versus the doing of mindfulness. So I prefer to translate sati as awareness for this purpose. It's more closer to a state than it is to a practice and an activity we do. It belongs to this other paradigm, not the paradigm of constructing and building and making something, but the paradigm of something growing and emerging and incubating, something emergent within us, something that we don't do, but something that we create the conditions for it to emerge and to grow. The common word we're like the practice people, right? What do you practice? You do, I'm practicing. Leave me alone, I'm practicing. We practice, practice, practice. It's amazing how much we practice. Amazing how much we use the word. The Pali word that's equivalent to what we're is bhavana. But bhavana can also mean to grow. And so rather than someone asks you, what are you practicing? They came and said, oh, what are you growing? What would you say? I'm growing sati, awareness. I'm growing faith. You can't do faith, can you? I can't do it. It's you can have it or you don't have it, but when you have it, you can grow it. You can allow it. Wisdom. You know, if we're not going to be the doer of wisdom, which we learned yesterday, we can grow wisdom. We can allow it to emerge. Do we do effort? Maybe that. But I kind of think of it sometimes that we're talking about vitality. You don't do vitality. That also can grow and evolve and develop. And my preferred way of understanding samadhi is something that grows as well. It's not something we do, but we create the conditions. And samadhi is a gift. That I feel every time I get concentrated nicely, I just feel so grateful. Wow, what a gift. I never feel like when I get concentrated that I did it. Even though in the past I've spent a lot of time huffing and puffing and trying to make it, but I've learned to not try, like a frontal assault on samadhi. It doesn't work. That's that other system. That's the constructive system, the building system, making system. the growing system, the farmer system, the egg system, operates on a very different principles. So sati is more like a state. But as a state, rather than calling it a mental state, because then for many people, well, at least I do, too easily, my mind goes up here to the top half of my head. Mental state, because by default, maybe, you know, my conditioning. But I think of it more as an embodied state that includes the mental state, or it's a mental state that's embodied. It's broad and wide, and it's something that suffuses. It's a suffusive field of sensitivity, suffusive field of awareness, of attentiveness, of presence. And the value of this is so important that there's a very dramatic poem in the Dhammapada that says something like, I don't memorize it exactly, negligent, to be heedless, to be mindless, is as if being already dead. To be vigilant, to be heedful, to be mindful, is as if you'll never die. That's kind of, I mean, religious people, you know, have this hyperbole that they use, right? And that was an example. But it's kind of dramatic, this idea that the contrast between really being alive versus being dead, in more polite circles, they just use the idea that most people are asleep. They live mostly asleep. They're not really alive, or they're only really present and attentive. They're so lost in their thoughts and their inner world and caught up in things. And then the opposite is to be awake. It's also a Buddhist metaphor. So when you hear that sati is a state that we grow, that we allow, that comes from this deeper source within, how do we allow that to appear? How do we bring it about? How do we make it happen? So I said the Buddha never told anyone to do mindfulness. What he did do is teach a few different practices that support the growth of sati, that help kind of create the conditions for it to be there. And the primary ones I'd like to mention today sometimes are called mindfulness in the modern world. So you'll hear it, oh, that's what mindfulness is. But technically it's not sati. It's a means to sati. It's creating the conditions for it. So one is to just recognize what's happening as things are happening, to know when you're breathing in, to know when you're breathing out, to know when you're sitting upright, to know when you're laying down. And this is a simple word, to know, so innocent. What I like about it is that there's no adjectives before it. It doesn't say, you know, stern knowing, ambitious knowing, hesitant knowing, greedy knowing, blast away my pain knowing. There's no agendas, there's no, it's just knowing. And so interesting exercise is, how simple can your knowing be? Like Andrea talked about, how simple and how little effort could she make? And that was apparently a kind of turning point for her to really understand something profound. How simple can your knowing be? Can you know without preference? Can you know without trying to accomplish something, to get something, to change something? Can knowing be a form of allowing what's there, being generous enough to allow what's there to be itself? There's my anger. Okay, I'll just know it. And then I'll just know it, just know it. No, it's anger. Not grit my teeth and say, anger. Or, oh no, alarm. Oh no, anger. How could it be? But just, oh, just anger. So matter of fact, so simple. How simple can you know it? And what that does is it leaves the anger alone. What's it leaving it alone from? From you. And your preferences and your judgments and your engineering and trying to make something happen and just anger. There's joy. Just how simple can you know it? There's a breath. How simple can you know it? And at first it might seem like this is ridiculous. I'm a sophisticated person. I do important things that have important purposes and get to important places. And know an in-breath as an in-breath. I mean, that's like kindergarten Buddhism. I'm ready for the sophisticated stuff, and I'm going to know, you know. And you're supposed to have insight into the three characteristics and impermanence and not self, and I'm going to really get in there and really discover those and see them, and I'm going to. It's just an in-breath. Oh, an in-breath. And guess what's not there in that simple knowing? Me, myself, and mine. All those ideas and stories of what I'm going to do and accomplish and how great I'll be when I finally wake up on a sink on an out-breath. Just an out-breath. Just how simple can you know? As we learn to know that simply and do it repeatedly, kind of almost like an exercise, how can I know and just know and know now and now? We're starting to get a feel for a mind or a heart which is free of a lot of the extra stuff that we're always bringing with us. Free of that wolf which doesn't do much good in the world. Free of the unskillful. Free of the constructing side of the human. We're always constructing and building and making up things. We just know. I can't help myself but to tell you a little story that I love. I've told it many times before, but just know something. A friend of mine wanted to go to San Francisco Zen Center to go there for, I think it was a retreat or something, be a guest student or something. And he called up and, well, the person who does the guest student thing is not here. You have to call back later. And so he called back later and he wasn't there. And so when he heard that the guest student manager wasn't there, he said, "I guess this means that this was never meant to happen." And the person at the desk, "No, it just means that Robert's not here." We add so many things on top, right? That means this, it means that. Just to know. And as we know in this simple way, and learn to trust that knowing, have confidence in it, then something begins happening. Awareness, the sense of a broader, spacious, more relaxed way of perceiving, registering, sensing begins to become more available to us. And that's the very room that allows something different, something inside of yourself which is not who you think you are, to operate. The wisdom arises. The faith arises. In that simplicity of knowing, there is maybe you start getting a sense of what this mind is like when it's free of the imperfections that soil it. And we begin feeling this is important, this is valuable, this way of being. I'm not going to get rich from this. I'm not going to all the things that I thought I had to do. But it turns out that this is the greatest wealth we have. Is this, this is the most beautiful thing, the most precious thing, is our own inner freedom. And it's portable. And we carry it with us wherever we go. So this sati that emerges in this radical simplicity of being is something then we want to notice it. And the food for sati is sati. The food for sati of mindfulness, of awareness, is to appreciate that you're aware. Ah. So we don't do awareness, we allow it. And then the Buddha talked about that, what he did, the verbs that the Buddha did talk about with sati was we abide in it. I love that. I once did a slideshow of sati, and for this abiding in awareness, I had a picture of a whale underwater in the great blue ocean. The whale is just abiding in sati in the ocean. Just, we abide. In this awareness. We don't do awareness. And so one of the points I would like to emphasize today is that this is a radical shift from how most people understand how they can be or should be and how they should live their lives. It's a whole different operating system than what we were taught or what society expected of us or what somehow we were trained to do. It's a totally different way. So if you don't understand that, it's all too easy to just continue with the old operating system while you're trying to do this practice. If the hen, its operating system for the hen, is I have to always go pecking up little pieces of corn and things and insects and stuff, so I'll just keep pecking my egg. That's what'll do it. But that's going to eventually break the egg before the chicks have a chance to grow. So we have to kind of learn how to do some kind of a radical shift. And it can be really hard to do this. And that's when effort sometimes needs to be courageous, to really, be willing to step into kind of an unknown, maybe a place where it's even a little bit scary. Because the usual reference points of how we are and who we are and how we accomplish and do things, and where we think that everything, that's the only way we're going to be safe or be successful, is not the way we're going to operate. But some of us, probably all of you in some way or other, know how to do this already, because it's kind of true for falling asleep. The times where I've tried to fall asleep, like I'm going to really try here, I couldn't do it. It just my mind was so kind of energized by the trying that wasn't going to do it. I'm going to make myself sleep. I had to kind of stop trying to make myself sleep and let something else operate. So I don't know how it is for you, or maybe I'm strange. But just like, just let it kind of, you know, just let that take care of itself, because if I get in there too much and too active or too worried about it, too concerned about it, then I just mess it up. I have to kind of get out of the way for sleep to happen. But you can't be, but it's, so with sati though, you also can't just, you know, just, well, you might as well just sit on the porch here in those nice chairs and just let it happen. I don't have to do anything, you know. You have to do something. You have to show up. And show up with your whole body, your whole being, the best you can. So the Buddha talked about what one of the things you do is to know, and this simplicity of knowing. And then he said to be, experience your whole body. Really kind of let this knowing be broad. Let the whole body support this knowing. There's something magical about the connection to the body and to awareness. Partly because what Buddha says next, to cultivate sati, to let the sati emerge, he next says, relax. Though the English translations are much more sophisticated, because they use the word tranquilize the body. But that doesn't... that doesn't work for most of us. I just like relax. It seems like a nice, simple, straightforward word. So know what's happening. Know here in your body what's happening. Know here what's happening in your mind. See how simple you can do that. Open up to feel your whole body to know all. Let your body wake up. Something way that's broad. Andrea talked about... you know, the humidity, how you know the humidity. There's this broad, expansive way of feeling or sensing, which you can't exactly put your finger on what you're doing. So, you know, just feel the body, open up. And if you do that, you'll probably will know something specific, very concrete. You might feel the tensions in your body. Your shoulders are tight and different things, stomach is held in. And sometimes there's little micro-muscles that maybe you don't even know they're tight. But to relax, to soften. And there's something about relaxing that also can make room for this awareness to appear. If, when you relax, take the time to feel the pleasure of that, to feel the goodness of that, to feel how that creates a little bit more space, a little more openness, and certainly in that areas in your body where you relax. To relax and then feel what's there. It's almost like you're letting the attention start in the place where you relax and let it kind of spread a bit. As if the relaxation spreads beyond the muscles right there. And then go back to the simple knowing. Simple knowing. So the Buddha offered other form of attention that we do. Occasionally what's useful is what he called sampajana, which is clear knowing. To really know. And, you know, to really recognize, oh, this is a short breath. This is chewing my food. This is sweet. This is sour. This is the feeling of the carpet against my feet. The texture. This is texture. Sometimes it's really kind of be so present that you can feel the particularity and recognize the particularity of your experience. Like the single raindrop, the first raindrop that falls on your head or on your forehead or something. Oh, that's very particular. It kind of opens up the field to a whole new thing to be attentive to. So sometimes what helps the awareness is the clear knowing and recognition. Sometimes it's for simpler knowing. Sometimes it helps when there's a dialing in and you see with greater clarity. And all this supports the continuity of being here, being present, so this awareness can grow. The growing of sati. We're farmers. We're not carpenters. And then the seasons change. You go to one sitting, one walking session, or one sitting, and you feel so settled and quiet. You go to the next one and you're all agitated. You go to the next one and you're dull and sleepy. You go to the next one and you feel kind of really quiet and calm. Wow! And after a while you see how they're always changing and shifting, which can be a great support when you realize, oh, this is how it is now. This is how the 145 sitting is today. Well, that's the way it is. I'll know it this way. Now I'm sleepy. I'll just know sleepiness the best I can, which is not so good. You know, you're supposed to, Dharma teachers are, you know, supposed to tell the war stories about, you know, how great they are and how much they, you know, practice so hard and, you know. And so my favorite war story to tell people is my battle with sleepiness. You know, I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning in Burma after 4 hours of sleep. So about 12 hours later in the afternoon, I started to get sleepy. And I would fight it and battle it, and I mean the gore and the blood. It was like, you know, my courage. Wow, this kind of little bit like a great, powerful warrior shadowed at boxing. There's no way I was going to win. But it took me a long time to understand that. And finally, one day I realized, wait a minute, Gil. You've been up since 2 o'clock in the morning. Of course you're tired. And then I realized all I had to do was not fight my sleepiness. All I had to do is practice the best way that I could, appreciating that it wasn't going to be that good. But it was the best that was available. And what I learned from that is it's the continuity of the best practice you can do that's available that carries you along in practice. You don't have to measure yourself against some high standard that's not available. Keep it simple. Oh, I'm hardly mindful. Wow, I said that so simply. Look at that. I recognized that I was hardly mindful and there was no baggage, nothing extra. Wow, isn't that cool? Keep it simple. Do the best you can. Don't be in a hurry to figure it out or to overcome things or to fix things. There's another way of finding your way through this. I don't say this so that you just get stuck and so that you just suffer more. I say this as a pointing that there's another way than you probably realize. And it's very radical. It's a radical shift to this other system. And I've learned that these battles and gore that I had with sleepiness, that sometimes I needed to sleep and sitting. And when I woke up from being asleep to meditation, I was so clear. I was so present and calm. Wow. So was it a mistake to be sleepy? To be dull? Who knows? Just do the best you can with it all. And then see, always see, how simple can I be with this? And maybe the treasure to be discovered in this practice is not accomplishing something with awareness and make something happen that's different than what's happening. The treasure is what you discover in the awareness and the simplicity, the freedom of it, the openness of it, the resting in it, the abiding in it, the surfing on it, the loving it. The treasure is in that awareness that is very close to that having nothing which soils the heart. No afflictions, no imperfections. Wow. That's where the chicks can develop. That's where these inner capacities, beautiful capacities we have, that can grow into states, embodied states of wisdom and concentration, awareness, vitality, and faith can grow and emerge. The emergent, the generative. So keep it simple. Walk simply. Sit simply. Eat simply. Whatever you do, drink your tea simply. Let there be a simplicity of knowing. And when you, as you do it, don't go looking for a treasure, for something special. If you go looking, it's probably that other operating system. Keep it simple and be available. Keep it simple and be open to what might come. Maybe without some idea of what it should be. Trust simplicity. Trust being available, being open. Trust this deeper process of what needs to emerge. And some of it might be difficult if we have unresolved issues within us. They finally will have a chance to emerge. Trust that too. The heart knows how to heal. The heart knows, the Dharma knows, your heart knows better than you, the Dharma knows better than you. Trust what emerges, make room for it, and know it as simply as you can. The simplicity of knowing is a protection. It's a safety. It's a safety to know simply. Just know the simple. One breath at a time, one moment at a time, one step at a time. And one day, your eggs will hatch, whether you want to or not. Thank you.